the rest of the cosmos is doing this like friendly interaction, curiosity, singing together, different birds singing. Maybe have way too many roosters. They'll yell, sing in response to some of the native birds and vice versa. And that doesn't submit to a Darwinist story of protecting, like, that's not a survival of the fittest story. That's just like, it's cool to sing, right? And when we see that in the whole cosmos, and then we look at how we live and decide, well, we are part of the cosmos or not, that was one of the ways that I made the story of something like fortune telling as old as fish, right? Like 500 million, no, that's actually 900 million years old, more. It doesn't matter. Over a billion years old. So play is over a billion years old. Humans might be kind of new, but that's the point. Like, we're downstream from play itself as an idea. And Lenormand, I think, just because of the accretion, you can do it with tarot. You can especially do it with a more European camellia way of approaching it. But you have to do it that way with Lenormand. You have to look at its fun.
Welcome to Coffee and Divination, a podcast about the arts of obtaining hidden knowledge in changing times. Join me, Joanna Farrar, to chat with experts from around the world on tarot, runes, geomancy, and the many ways divination can help us navigate and plan our paths ahead. It's always a pleasure to have a guest and friend return to the show. In this case, author and magician Gordon White. In addition to having published a number of books on magic mythology and the ways that spirit engagements have been a vital part of humanity for millennia, he is also a practicing permaculturalist on his farm in Tasmania. Permaculture is something we have in common. And he's the founder of Rune Soup, which is both a podcast and blog, as well as now a multifaceted online school of magic of sorts. His most recent release is Fortune's Fools, a Lenormand oracle deck co-created with artist Colin Alexander. The cards themselves are gorgeous, and I've already enjoyed exploring them since I received my copy. Included with the deck, instead of a typical little white book, which only applies to the deck it's bundled with, Gordon has written a concise and helpful short book about cartomancy and how to think about it and practice it well. In our conversation today, we dive into the nature of play, risk, the reality of omens around us, and how to engage, hopefully with humility and respect, in the storied arts of fortune-telling. For those watching the video version, there were a few weird little glitches with my video feed during the interview, but those don't interrupt the sound or any important parts of the video, so just know that and enjoy anyway. Before we start, just a quick note to say, if you enjoy our content, please subscribe, share it with friends, and leave us a good review on Apple Podcasts. You can always find out more about the show on our website at coffeeanddivination.com. Enjoy!
So thank you, everyone, for tuning in, and I am so excited to have back on the show a favorite guest, Gordon White, and I am happy to have him here to speak about one of his most recent releases, which is an incredible deck for fortune telling, Fortune's Fools, and the book that goes with it. So we will be talking about everything that has gone into that and the way that it was created, as well as our interesting discussion of fortune telling around the exact deck that you've created. So thank you so much for being here, Gordon, to talk about it.
It's an absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So this project, I want to talk a little bit about the process that you followed with the artist in creating this, because I think it's so fascinating. Can you just tell us a little bit about how it got started and what you were aiming to create when you first were endeavoring to do this?
Sure, absolutely. So I came to the Lenormand, I suppose, kind of late as a system, which is to say within the last decade or so. I found tarot when I was about 13 or 14, and I found Sibylla, so other playing card-ish oracle decks. And then I found Lenormand. And it took a while, and I kind of realized that here's a project that's only ever going to have almost like limited popularity. I'm sure you have a tarot podcast, you're aware that there's less crossover than you would think. So I wanted to do something about fortune telling. I delighted in the idea of a project being small and intimate and available, just like at a come by, be involved, zero input, zero pressure. This is what's going on if you feel called to do it. And then we all got, you know, imprisoned, in my case, in a whole country so on around the world. And a lot of stuff was being done remotely, which we were talking about before we hit record. And I thought this is the right time for this project. If it's going to be any time, it's going to be now. So it was an experiment in what we can do, I guess, at the level of the field together. So the project was myself and Colin. Colin Alexander is a Scottish artist. And we'd been Twitter friends for years beforehand. We've actually never met in person, but we'd been Twitter friends for years, bonded over various things like RuPaul and other very online gay jokes and so on. So I could kind of hit him up about it. He wasn't doing anything because artists are never doing anything. And he's like, yeah, okay, cool. And then we just had a weekly show for each of the cards and a few more around it where we would talk about, there's 36 cards in a Lenormand deck. And we began, and we do it at a scheduled time live. And it's interesting to look back at the early episodes that the digital platforms that are available for live streaming have improved dramatically in the several years that that went on. But it was really fun. Like, so people could just join in on the YouTube chat and comment and observe and throw suggestions in for what we'll do with the art. So each week we talk about the signification of a particular card, whether it's the rider, whether it's the ship. And we talk about what's going on with the project. And it was really fun. It was just kind of like a fun thing for people to jump in on. And all the episodes are still available live. And I was talking to someone the other week about this, actually, that if you were new to Lenormand, a case can be made for starting at the beginning and going through that project, probably at 1.5 speed, you know, times money. But we end up having quite a in-depth discussion about, I mean, inevitably, about fortune telling, about the Lenormand cards, about how symbol and image work in fortune telling, and so on. So there's this really deep and rich discussion, if I may say so myself, over the course of this project. And that was the idea. Other artists have done this with tarot before, where they've done live stream conversations with artists building a deck. So that part wasn't breaking new ground. Doing it with Lenormand, which it turns out, I mean, my background's in the magical world as well. Very few people in the magical world are interested in it, and almost no one in the tarot world is interested in it. So it's this funny thing that exists for people who want to really kick the tires, I suppose, on the metaphysics of fortune telling in general. Now, I just got back from Paraguay because it's popular in Brazil. Well, more popular than it is in the West. And I was they're called Santerias, actually, but the Botanicas, the magic stores, are typically run by Brazilians. And it was very gratifying to spend a couple of months in Asuncion and going into these Santerias and seeing all these different versions of Lenormand going, yes! So there are people other than me who like this and who use it. And I actually got to gift my deck to a mother of an Umbanda house that I did a bunch of ceremonies with while I was over there. She doesn't speak a word of English. Obviously, the book is in English. So she's going page by page with an app that apparently automatically translates and is reading the book. And I'm mortified. There's so many gay jokes in it, but she loves the deck. She's been reading for her clients with Lenormand anyway. And I'm like, there's a lot of like gay culture specific stuff that's not necessarily going to translate to an Umbanda house on the edge of Asuncion in Paraguay. But that was just to bring it all back to, that's exactly what I wanted for the project. I wanted to see if one can engage at the field level of fortune telling. And the reason I tell the Paraguay story is you can, and it will ultimately reap results.
Absolutely. It is interesting to me when I was telling some friends of mine that are also witches about your deck, and they're like, oh, we don't use those decks. We've heard that's really complicated or it's really difficult. And it is. I mean, it is its own thing, and therefore it has its own learning curve, although we're going to get into what exactly that means a little later. But it is interesting to kind of watch it. I think it is expanding, though. I've seen in Wiccan and witch circles it getting more popular. So I'm happy to see that.
It might be having its cool moment. I think it's more that people are emotionally and psychologically exhausted with peak tarot. We're about 18 months, I would say, past peak tarot. And people are like, God, let there be something new. And it is. The way the project worked is a typical Kickstarter style project where there was a top tier funding, and part of the top tier funding was personal tuition, like a full course. And at the end of the course, one of the people who did so said, I feel like I've joined some strange, mysterious cult. And also that they, by the time they'd finished, they went back to play with their tarot cards. And the guy in question has been reading tarot cards for 30, 35 years. And he's like, I feel like I've forgotten how to do it. So there is absolutely a different mode of fortune telling that you get with Lenormand. And that was one of the other kind of hiding your vegetables in the kids' food reasons for doing it. Because I get very Camellia Elias about the persistence of almost like a neurodivergent memory game, silly approach to tarot that I find very frustrating. And you absolutely cannot do that with Lenormand. And I think that's why when some people say, oh, that's really complicated, it's not. It's just not this this like Aspie game of, oh, it's the Seven of Swords again. This means that. It's not that silly game of tarot, which it doesn't describe all of tarot, obviously. I mean, I just mentioned Camellia as a good example. But that's nevertheless a persistent mode. And you can't do that. Well, you can, I suppose, with Lenormand. You can do anything, but the language of Lenormand is far more relational, and so it's absolutely a different mode, and it's arguably a reason to do it rather than not to.
Okay, there's a number of different directions I could go with that. I'm going to go with one of the earlier questions I had in my list, so we can work our way down. With that description of the relationality of Lenormand, and particularly with the deck that you have created with Colin, it is, you describe it first and foremost at near the beginning as animist, as opposed to supernatural, that you kind of classify tarot as supernatural as opposed to Lenormand, or particularly this deck, as animist. We've already both, you know, you've just touched on Camellia. I'm a huge Camellia fan as well. So I'm sure that you're not meaning that to be exclusionary to tarot in the sense that it cannot be animist. No. But I was curious if you could go into that not. A little bit, what you mean by that, especially we're at the beginning of the show, if you want to Cliff's Notes, animism, what am it?
Sure. Animism is, I wrote a whole book about it, but it's a complex word that, and the reason I wrote about it is it's complex, but broadly speaking, it is the experience of a universe composed of persons rather than things, and principally composed of relations between persons. So humans are persons, but so are trees, so are river spirits, so are whatever. And the origin of the major arcana, let's just use the words we have for it in the tarot, appears to be, like, best case historical analysis is essentially like mystery performances of like medieval mystery performances of Christianity and Christian stories that would travel around Europe, and they tell different stories to an illiterate masses with performances and so on. So you end up with a collection of symbols that are necessarily high drama. So I call tarot supernatural, but I also call it extra, like in a telenovela gay sense, right? So if you look at the card list for, and that's good and bad, but if you look at the card list for the major arcana, you have the devil himself, you have a woman pretending to be the Pope, you have like all this kind of really Zeffirelli film operatic drama. And the tarot has kings and queens and all this kind of stuff, right? God himself is 9/11-ing a building. It's like, it's crazy, but it's really extra. It's drama. It's really Italian. Then you look at the Lenormand and you have some little birds and somebody's dropped a ring and there's a closed book and a key. And the worst or the most kind of the bad card, the worst card in the deck is a coffin. Is that the same thing as death? Yes, but it's actually more intimate, right? And I wanted to make sure that that's shown because death can be a plague. It can be genociding a million children in an open air prison. A coffin is always like a really bad day for somebody, like somebody standing next to the coffin. So Lenormand has what I would call like a quotidian intimacy. It is the story of the aliveness of the little things of our life. So a case, I mean, I love tarot. I said that repeatedly in the book. I love it. Obviously it's, I love all forms of fortune telling and cartomancy. One of the things Lenormand offers though is a inward or small turn to the small sacred, whereas tarot situates your story in high drama. The devil stalks the land. You know, it's quite big. And typically when we come to fortune telling, the question is, does he still love me? You know, they are beautiful little questions. They're not, shall I invade Portugal? It's not like a huge story. And I really wanted to center that in Lenormand, I suppose, because the book is not just an exploration of Lenormand, it is a demonstration of why anyone who's interested in cartomancy should look again at it and what and why. Like, where does it belong in the toolkit of a competent jobbing fortune teller? Because you don't, it's not binary. You don't like go, okay, I'm a Lenormand reader now. I'm just going to tip all my tarot cards into the fireplace. We are done. And that's, I think, part of it. And that was the key difference. So when I say tarot is supernatural, it's because it is a very operatic, and I love this about it, but a very operatic medieval Christian more moral play, right? And Lenormand is a game, basically like a game of life with the Milton Bradley one we played as kids. It's literally just a game, and it's lots of beautiful little stories. There's a child card, there's just a house card, all that kind of stuff. And that's the key, I would say, metaphysical difference, that it's small and relational, and that's reflected in how the cards are used.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, side tangent, but it is interesting, I think, with seer work and oracular stuff from ancient Greece is, you know, an interest of mine because of the work that I do as a seer. But it's also interesting to note that a lot of those famous stories we have, even about something like, you know, the Pythia, usually are about, well, do you invade or not? And really, for the most part, the people that would be coming and asking these questions would be, you know, should my daughter marry this person or that person? Or, exactly. You know, what is my child going to get well? Like, that's the heart of these things.
Yes, exactly. And I like centering the beauty of that, right? That's, and Lenormand can do that. And I will say, I think, maybe you'll agree or disagree, I think one of the reasons Lenormand, at least in Magicland in the West, has been historically kept to the side is because it is kind of womanish. Its concerns are bourgeois womanish. And that is just the typical boy magic nonsense of the 19th century Golden Dawn approach, which put, you know, Pamela Coleman Smith to the side of the deck that she actually created, amongst others. And I think there's part of that still in Lenormand, because it is geared for 19th century parlor pastimes, which are typically performed by women and have womanish concerns, right? Like, literally, where, who is my daughter going to marry? Like, my father-in-law is sick, or where are we going to live? Those things that I think are like the beautiful truisms of life. And it's just, you don't get to play the big famous wizard with like Lenormand, like you can with tarot. There's a memory game flex if you come to tarot from magic, where like, oh, I'm going to memorize all the deckhands and I'm going to memorize, like, ugh. And that is impossible with Lenormand, and that's to its credit.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That there is quite a bit of that distinction, which has arbitrarily been made for many, many different reasons, within magic and within divination. So that is very important to always remember.
Right, because as far as I can tell, the majority of people who are involved in cartomancy are female, but the field of tarot correspondences still has like big Freemasonic male energy. It's weird. Like, and the best writers of the last few decades have all been female. Anyway.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Camellia and of course the well anyway. I think part of what getting from what you were talking about, the little things, and also connecting back to what you were first saying about how the conversations about the deck and so how it was actually conceived and created goes back to another section that you talk about early in the book, which is on the nature of play in divination and magic, which I have to say is probably like one of my favorite sections. It's, you know, I really enjoyed the book all the way through, but as a violinist, as well as a witch, you know, that idea of play and that idea of the sacredness of play, the complexity of it, which is, I think you point out very rightly, not appreciated or intentionally pushed to the side in our culture, is very important. I wanted to If you would indulge me, I'm going to read just a tiny segment from that section. It is a surprisingly radical act to recenter play, especially in-person play. Do it often enough, and you begin to see through the non-consensual games of culture we have all been forced to participate in. We used to treat games better. On one level, we used to recognize that games can be vectors for joy, and the universe in a real sense runs on joy, on desiring better into the future. There is a shared reality underneath the mantra, the manta playing in the surf, and two Austrian women laying a game of hope in their parlor. It is simply being alive in that very moment. How then could a game be a distraction? To me, it seems like there's an element of play in how the whole thing was created and in what you're trying to recenter this into. Is there anything that you want to add to that? And also, it's a huge conversation to open, but obviously, why do you think our culture has had such a Protestant capitalist view of play for so long?
Well, it's the Protestant capitalism. That's the quick part of it, because it doesn't.
Version.
Yeah. Like, again, I just spent 2 months in the weirdest Latin American country I've ever been to. And it's Latin America, so there's soccer and everything. But how they live is not, because they're and Paraguay is a strange place. In the 30s, they had a dictator who banned marriage between people of the same race. Like, you actually had to interracially marry. And it's the country has the weirdest history. The reason for that is he looked across at Buenos Aires, he looked at Argentinian culture, and saw still all the white people at the top, like this top 0.5% governing over an endless sea of like brown indigenes, right? He's like, well, we're not having that in Paraguay, and he was a dictator. So whilst I don't approve of forcing anyone to marry anyone, I get the logic. Consequently, it's a surprisingly, and Paraguayans don't realize this, surprisingly more, there's a mix of Catholicism and typically Guarani culture, which is just antithetical to all the ways that we organize value. When we think of like a Protestant capitalist approach, that, oh, my mother has a store in the front of her house. I'm like, what time does she open? It's like, it's literally whenever she's in the front of her house. Like, they don't, it's almost like, and this to their credit, they don't understand capitalism. So they all hang out drinking tereré, which is what I'm drinking here, like cold tea, just vibing, just talking about soccer. I desperately needed to see that. Like, the reason you're correct to see that play was built into the project from the start, and in my case exactly, that was ayahuasca's orders. I essentially had to do, it almost felt like adult physiotherapy after a serious accident. Like, I had to relearn play at an from ayahuasca's orders, because she's like, you will basically die of stress if you need to play more. And I'm like, yeah, but I don't know how to do that. What is that, like Warhammer 40k, like when I was 14? Please say yes. She didn't, sadly. So she's like, you have to play. And I'm like, oh. And I had to learn that from the beginning. And because I had to learn it from the beginning, I literally had to arrange play dates for myself. So that was the shows with Colin and beginning that exploration of joy. And it's because of, well, I mean, my personal trauma, everyone has it, right? But also my personal trauma is downstream from how we arrange and value different things in culture to do with success and what have you. And it was weird because the manta story you mentioned, when I was, what was that? I guess I was 19 and filming a documentary in Micronesia on Nan Madol. We're doing some additional diving, and I saw some manta rays, which was amazing anyway, but they were just playing. And play is always, they were doing backflips, like leaping out of the water. And biologists have tried to say that they're like running away from stuff, or they're moving, they're trying to get rid of bugs that are on their skin. We were at a manta cleaning station. They'd all just come off, they fly over the top of this mound of coral, and all these little fish come up and clean them, eat the little bugs and things that grow in them, and then off they go. So it's like a car wash for manta rays. These are the cleanest manta rays in the ocean, and they're playing. And it's like, they were just doing it because it's fun. I live in a rural environment like you do. And knowing that, I watch, you can see videos of it on TikTok or whatever, where like there might be an upturned tortoise and a bird will come by and look at it and then just kick it over so that it's upright again. The rest of the cosmos is doing this like friendly interaction, curiosity, singing together, different birds singing. Maybe have way too many roosters. They'll yell, sing in response to some of the native birds, and vice versa. And that doesn't submit to a Darwinist story of protecting, like, that's not a survival of the fittest story. That's just like, it's cool to sing, right? And when we see that in the whole cosmos, and then we look at how we live and decide, well, we are part of the cosmos or not, that was one of the ways that I made the story of something like fortune telling as old as fish, right? Like 500 million, no, that's actually 900 million years old, more. It doesn't matter. Over a billion years old. So play is over a billion years old. Humans might be kind of new, but that's the point. Like, we're downstream from play itself as an idea. And Lenormand, I think, just because of the accretion, you can do it with tarot. You can especially do it with a more European camellia way of approaching it. But you have to do it that way with Lenormand. You have to look at its fun. And part of the project for me was that medicinal play-based physiotherapy that I literally had to begin with structured play because I was so, so out of practice with it. And I still am. Like, I have to remind myself to stop doing, I guess because I really like my job, I have to stop doing things that are explicitly work-based and go and do something play-based, or otherwise it won't happen. I'm getting better at it, but that's part of it. And I would argue that most people who are downstream from the collection of decisions that is Protestant capitalism will struggle with the same issue. If they think about it going like, I don't take play seriously. And the science has been in for like 70 years that if you don't take play seriously, you will lose 2 decades of your life minimum. Like you were not going to de-stress correctly if you're not doing play.
I appreciate you adding that. And then there's also another part of me that knows that the fact that we both have to add in that like you will take away 2 decades of your life as like a health reason for all of us to do this thing, which every other animal just knows to do.
Exactly.
Just kind of makes
like
you
everything
sigh,
else about being human. Well, because I got to the end of that statement and I'm like, I know there are people listening who are like, you know, I don't play enough. Maybe I'll, and it's one of those things you hear in a podcast, like, oh, I should do that. Like, oh, I should buy some methylene blue. Like, it'll go into that to-do list that you get from the podcast in your head that you never fulfill. So there's always that bit. I'm going to tip that to another to-do list, which
exactly.
is I'm going to effectively threaten your life a little if you don't play.
Yeah, which is, I think that goes to something which is interesting to me. And I'll sort of say, when we're talking about divination, we're talking about fortune telling, and we're talking about play, and we're talking, for me as a violinist, it's always an interesting thing because I'll have sometimes people come to me on stage after a concert and say, oh, you must have fun every time you do this. And just like, you know, when we are doing magic, there is an element of play and fun always. And of course, when you're doing music, anything creative, like writing, I'm sure for you, it's fun. We do it because it's fun. There's an element of joy underneath it. However, there's also something very serious about it, which is, you know, like underlying it. So we have to be able to hold both the joy of it and also the seriousness at the same time.
Well, that's a good map to fortune telling, right? Because I have clients on a weekly basis, and in the healing sessions, very often we use now my Lenormand cards, which is amazing to be able to use your own cards in a session. But people are going through some serious shit. So it's all well and good to say like, play and fortune telling is downstream from play, but we have to do two things, which is to realize that one, play isn't only joyous. You know, killer whales play with seals when they eat them, right? So play is a method of engagement, of relating, but also it's serious business. So you can't be joking and whimsical when someone's just lost a child. You know, it's like but that's all of that is that the bigness of the sanctity of fortune telling, like it has to be big enough to contain all of that. The correct predictions for happy marriages, as well as like the consolation when it comes to deep sadness, like that's what it's for, you know?
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. And I think you also, I am a member of Rune Soup and your tarot course, which was a while back. In that course and also in this book and in many other things that you've said besides, you emphasize oftentimes the, not quite sure how I would put it into words, the thing that comes to me is sort of like a re-blooding or a sort of like re-earthing of some of the ways that we engage with fortune telling, which is why you prefer the word fortune telling to divining. And that there is a sort of high mystical air that's got wrapped around the tarot, a kind of, as you pointed out, because of the nature of the images and sort of the drama of it in and of itself, but also just the way that people interacted with it in a very, this must be about the fate of the soul and the way that we approach the divine and things of very large nature, as opposed to, you know, does he love me? Should I take this trip? If so, am I going to have a good time? That kind of bringing it back down to earth and bringing that back down the smaller things we've also spoken about. But in the book, you also bring out its relationship to gambling and the idea of sitting down at the table with fate, which, as a person who doesn't gamble, I don't like casinos. They're just bright and loud, and it's not really my scene. I thought that was a very interesting thing.
I don't like
thing.
Buffets, and I don't gamble. So, and I never liked Celine Dion. It's like, what is for me in here?
So, is that for me? I think that the interesting part about that was looking at engaging with fortune telling and divination of different forms as engaging with risk, because we are sort of playing with fate. So we go back to play, but we're going back to how does that engage with the forces of fate, which I think is also why I've had some conversations with people and they get a little afraid of fortune telling. And I was wondering if you could speak a little bit to that fear or what you think about that sort of danger element in it.
So, to some extent, the fear is justified. I don't think either of us are unserious, even if we approach it with play, right? So if you look at the origin, tarot cards, Lenormand, everything is downstream from playing cards. And so if you look at the story of the arrival of playing cards into Europe and it's spreading out from there, they were almost instantly banned everywhere they showed up. And you have to understand, like, what would these look like to people who don't have yet a probabilistic understanding of math, which came in like the 17th century? That's an oversimplification, but it'll do, because let's not do a history of mathematics. So you have a relationship to the future where it is curious and alive and unreliable, dangerous and belonging to God. That's the key in Europe, is like, you don't do fortune telling because the future belongs to God. That's like, no. And if you're doing that, you're effectively doing something to do with the devil. No one's sure quite what or in what situation, but it is. And that is super interesting to me, right? Because you have a deck of cards and you sit down at a tavern and you are playing some sort of game for money. And you probably aren't card counting because, again, you don't really have that mathematical understanding. So you're doing it in a dangerous context already, because someone might stab you for your money. And whether or not you win or lose is up to God, but it's in the cards. And so that, plus you have to think, I think about the Lewis chess pieces, right? There's beautiful little carved Northern Scottish, whatever they were, 500, 600 AD in the British Museum. Same thing. When you look at the origin of chess, no, it's actually 800, doesn't matter. You are moving opposing kings and armies around, and you're doing that in a animate, alive cosmos. You're doing something about the moving around of pieces or cards has something to do with fate. And we know, as people who've read cards, that more often than not, when whatever is on the cards has something to say about things that then go on to happen. So it wouldn't have been long before, after the arrival of cards or chess pieces or what have you, before people understood, that's weird, because like last night we were playing that game and then this happened, to understand that there's a mysterious relationship between the moving around of pictures of things and their subsequent play out. And that, so it's funny, like I'm opposed to the idea of banning playing cards and so on. But I get the logic. I actually get the logic. If you're a burgomeister of some town in Austria and all of a sudden you've got these strange people playing these, stabbing each other and playing with cards. And it's like, you're doing stuff about money and gambling that's about the future. And that's where tarot comes from. It's downstream. We got playing cards first. But the crucial thing to understand is that that's not a game. That's not, when we were playing in the 14th and 15th century, we weren't playing in a disenchanted universe. We actually understood, dare I say, better the context of play being somehow a bit mysterious. So I have sympathy for people When you look at Atea in, let's look at the Frenchies from the end of the 18th century to the early 19th century, who were the ones who stole a bunch of ideas from gypsy women, of course, put them in books, set themselves up in hotels with little turbans and whatever, and became great mystical swamis. And this is where we get most of the super sacred correspondences from, a act of mansplaining theft. So the reason you have to kind of organize it that way is France was the other great Enlightenment project. And by like the 19th century, it was a very mechanical, materialist universe. And you had to do you had to jump above the prevailing rationalism to get a bit of the sacred. And that's kind of what happened to tarot. It's like you gypsy women are primitive, superstitious fools. And so what they believe about the cards, we don't believe anymore because this is enlightened France. So you had to kind of jump above the rationalism. And we've done that a number of times in the tarot journey. So tarot's sanctity hid behind psychology in the 20th century. And it hid behind this Egyptomaniacal philosophical wisdom in the 19th century. In the 21st century, rather, I don't think it needs to hide quite so much, but I do think it needs, as a result, to gather up all the pieces. And I say it that way. What I did with the tarot course was begin with play, the stuff we're talking about, and bring the story up to that 19th century organizational moment, so that it is, so that you don't have to choose between the two. So very often people will come to tarot first through a very Smith-Waite world of this means that, and this card is this decan, and memorizing all this stuff. And then they're faced with the prospect, if they read Camellia's work or whoever, like, to go, that's all crap. You don't need to do that. You just need to read what's on the cards, which is true. But if we sequence it that way, we understand that the organizational moment is a thing that happened to the cards on their journey, and you are allowed to use it that way. You don't have to choose between the two of them. You just have to make sure that you're not explaining, quote unquote, how the cards work by recourse to the Golden Dawn correspondences. That is now a thing that they can tell you about, because the cards have a 500-year journey, and that's like 150 years of it. And that's, I guess, the key to how we situate the origin of this discussion with play and cards and mystery and danger, which is where it began. And a mysterious object will do strange things, like pick up astrology, swing by Paris and pick up astrology on its way. Like, that's the point. And it's all a question of sequencing and attending upon a different line of history. And then you get to have your cake, your French cake, and eat it too.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it can take on aspects and take on sort of faces as it goes, as it changes.
I think that people, I know from having a bunch of tarot friends, right, that especially if they've been doing tarot even professionally for, you know, 10, 20 years, and they've been running off the classical correspondences, well, they're not even classical, they're literally white. they're like, and then you say, well, that's crap. Not so much that it's crap, but like, that's actually not in the cards. That's a thing that happened to the cards. They freak out a bit, and to some extent, rightly so, because, well, hang on, I've just done 20 years of this, some of it professionally, and it's worked. So what do you mean it's not in the cards? And I'm like, well, that's, we come inevitably back to the metaphysics of what is a card and what is playing cards at that point. But so I get people's reticence, because like, they've got a system to work with that, but that's not proof of origin. That's proof that things like cards work.
Yeah. And that kind of goes back a little bit to something you said towards the beginning there, which was the idea that, you know, you understand, I am not a fan of banning books or banning cards or banning magic or any of these things, obviously. But when you step into a worldview where these things are real, then you do have to understand the fears of them. And I think Ronald Hutton in the Witch book, you know, from a couple of years ago, is one of the last chapters, says, which I bring up to other, you know, witches and neo-pagans all the time, where I'm like, you do realize if people accept this as real, we actually have some problems. We have potentially some of the dangers that, you know, meant people died or, you know, still are in danger of persecution. And many of the people within tarot's history and divination's history have also succumbed to, because of that recognition of its realness and what we do with that as a culture and as a people. That's very difficult. I don't
When
have
I
the
was,
answer, I'm sure.
no, but I do have a scale Paraguay story. We were driving back from the Banda house back into Asuncion, and we drove past, and it's a hot country, so this is part of it. We drove past an awkward goth teen, which put me in memory of my own awkward goth years. And it occurred to me, hang on, here is a country that not so much like Brazil, but there are a bunch of different Umbanda, Kimbanda houses around and so on, mostly in the Brazilian diaspora. But it's also the most Catholic country in South America, which is really saying something. And I didn't see anyone brazenly displaying their, let's say, alternative spiritual path. And it's because this is the, like, picture a sliding scale or an X cross graph. In societies that think this is all fake, you have to perform the identity much louder, and you can do that in a safer space. So, like, I got to dress like a really awkward Church of Satan style goth teen. It was a phase. We all go through something like that in regional Australia. But if I dressed like that in Asuncion as a teenager, I would be spat on in the street. I would have problems. Like, people would avoid my family, and who knows, right? Because we might not see the world that a devout Catholic would, but they're at least right that there's something to this. And so consequently, people who know how to do things don't call themselves, which is still a bad word there. Like, no one would call themselves that. You still know the particular auntie to go to who has the cards. So it comes back to that, that deed without a name idea. And I find that super interesting, just to add on to your comment, that in Paraguay, I saw one goth teen and no one would name each other, and no one would do that. And then I think about everyone's, but it's because they all know it's real. And here I got to grow up being boorishly performative and boring people with my newfound Llewellyn book wisdom at age 16. And that, it's super interesting. So I find that illustrative as a way into coming to understand why the authorities in these European towns and cities would ban stuff, because they all know it's some kind of real.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, I think that takes us to omen logic, which omen logic is a very, very large topic. and you obviously dive into it in this book, because we cannot talk about trying to come to meaning through cards or the flight of birds or just about anything else without talking about what omen logic is. So for people who may not be familiar with your definition, can you just give us something about that?
Sure. So I think that's a term I came up with for the tarot course, right? And it's like, just coming back to fine, Gordon, Waite, Atea, all these, Eliphas Levy, all these people, their ascriptions of meaning and how the tarot cards work is arbitrary. Fine. And yet it does work. So how does it work? And for me, the answer to that is omen logic, which is that, as far as I can tell, and I've looked a bunch of places around the world, the closest thing we have to a universal belief that we've all come out of, and most people, most societies have retained, is essentially a hermeticism. Is essentially an idea that because the universe is composed of people relating, those relations mean things, and there is some eerie relationship between a picture of a thing and a thing. Egyptian civilization was built on that notion, like, quite literally. They would build their temples to map the stars. But this idea that a living, animate, interrelating cosmos consequently has, I hate the word symbolism, but has a logic of communicating within its beings is reflected, I think, in the cards. And so I call it omen logic because it's a really, especially in our denatured, de-magicked world, it's an innocuous way into a quite eerie understanding. So in one of my other books, I talk about becoming invincible in the sense of having like a really quote unquote big supernatural experience, end quote, like famously taking the Ouija board into a abandoned mental hospital in the middle of the night. Tarot isn't as, or fortune telling isn't quite like that. But if you sit with, well, how the shit did that work? For long enough, it starts to become eerie. Like if you go, hang on, well, it's not because it's a secret book written by Thoth that survived down from Egypt to describe how the stars work. That's crap.
It's not something.
Yeah, but like it's something. And the way it speaks, when you step into a omen logic, which is to say that the universe is always communicating, speaking's not correct, it's always relating and engaging and communicating, like my birds singing to each other, literally music, song of the birds. When you understand that tarot or Lenormand is an opportunity to participate in that discussion, that's omen logic, because they show up, and when you lean into it, you get better at it. So when you understand that it's not, this card doesn't mean the third decan of Scorpio or whatever, but when you understand that it's communicating in this animist organic level, and it doesn't quite work with our puny human notions of things like time and numbers, then you get better at realizing what it's trying to say. And that's omen logic. It is informed by the fact that when I look at classic ufology, like the work of Jacques Vallée, he realized there's something about UFO phenomena that relate to culture. And there's something that they're doing where they're interacting with how we understand image and story and text, and that they've always done that, and that that's part of the phenomena. So when I say omen logic, you start with tarot cards and all of a sudden you're reading Jacques Vallée's Dimensions and going, there's something about that that relates to this, because I can use it to predict when my cousin's going to show up with the Christmas gifts for the kids. Like, and that's omen logic. So if I'm going to, which is how I thought about it, if I'm going to take away the magic of the Eliphas Levi, Wait, Etea, astrological secret book of Thoth thing, if I'm going to take away the magic, I should probably give some back. I should probably say, well, this is how I think they work, because I think the whole universe works like this. I think it puts cards in the same continuum as any form of fortune telling, from I Ching to ornithomancy to watching birds to just literally, it's not exactly the same, but also just like asking God what you should do next. Like it's about engaging with a cosmos. It's stepping into a conversation that includes the whole cosmos and beginning to understand its language, its logic of communication.
Which involves, I think, immediately paying attention, which is an incredibly difficult thing, especially with the way that we have sort of been encultured and trained not to pay attention as people in the modern world, especially to anything that is not of our own creation. As I say, staring into a camera, everything about what we are doing right now in some sense has to do with human technology. So that fact that we are sort of insulated within human created landscapes can make that more difficult. But I think there was a spot, and I've forgotten his name, someone who was a guest on your show who talked about the difference between, instead of calling something the gift of the sight, it's the gift of the noticing. And I particularly like that, because I think that is a part of omen logic, is the act of actually being able to attend in a way that is different from either everyday reality or just what we are used to using as we walk around in the world. And that can take the form of when we work with cards, or just in how we interact with the world with other forms of divination. That being said, we're starting to get to elements of what technology, what being good at these arts really are, which for me, I am often fascinated with what people consider the technology of these art forms really are. For example, when it comes to a very specific thing like playing the violin, there is a set of techniques. There are things that you need to be able to do in order to play a certain piece of music. Yeah. What you do, how you play with it, what you can do with other people with it, that's a thing that's a mystery. It's a beautiful mystery. However, there is still tech that can be broken down very simply. I think in your book, which we'll get to a little bit later, there you do give people very, very specific techniques about questions, etc. But what do you consider essential elements of technique of good fortune telling. What does that mean to have good technique as a fortune teller?
Yeah, the metaphysics of the question, I would say, is key. It's funny, like, are there mechanical things? Like, you want to say, do you have the dexterity to be able to, like, do you have fingers? And I don't even know if that's quite necessary, because you can use online versions, or you could ask someone else. I do think it comes down to learning how to ask good questions. And good questions for tarot cards or Lenormand or I Ching are different. Not entirely. They're 50% different and 50% identical. And one of them, which I learned from Camellia, which I think is really good, is never go to the cards if you don't have a question, because it's just pictures on paper when you do that. And for me, when she said that, when I learned that from her, it brought up Jung, as it usually does for me, and his trying to grapple with why depth psychology was so effective and what it was he was actually doing. And he said, there's something about asking a question that constellates the unconscious around us. So it's to ask a question is to get good at it, because what you're doing there is the same thing that I think those town elders in the Middle Ages were concerned about. You are the universe, because it's relational, will somehow respond to a question that's asked of it, right? Because I consider the unconscious to be identical to the spirit world, and so, and thus probably, like, we're in it, it's not in us. So when Jung says constellating the unconscious, that's true as far as those things go, but it's more like the cosmos arranges itself in response to a question, because it arranges itself in response to anything. So realizing that actually you're going to begin or end with getting the question right. And let's say that's 60% of the technique. Let's skip shuffling. I have some idiosyncratic rules that are me specific that I learned as a teenager that I use for that, rather than stuff that I would necessarily teach, because it's not the strongest area of technique for me. Then it is, so I have a sequence that I've kind of always used when it comes to fortune telling with cards. And I use, and in fact, I make sure the decks conform to this technique. And if they don't, I don't use them. So I don't, and that is to begin with a gestalt. So you lay out the cards and this is especially true for, I guess, more European style versions of reading, but most of your answer is going to be instantly there, because most questions fall into a yes, no, or at least positive, negative. So the technique for me then is to begin with gestalt and then do a very, very Camellia thing, and then like, well, what's on the cards? And so the ascribed meanings, the Atean stuff, is tertiary. It comes through at the third level at the earliest. Sometimes it's the fourth, right? Because it's what's on the cards, what are they doing to each other? So that's the technique. And this is the real, I think, genius of Camellia's approach, is that she ties that to the metaphysics of the question, because that's what frees you. And that's the thing that's like the easiest. It's like riding a bike. The easiest and most difficult thing, I think, in her system to get is the cards will only ever respond to a question, and they will always do it by what's on the cards. That's the read like the devil moment. And it's difficult. It's actually easy for people who've never memorized some Golden Dawn things to do, because it's like, oh, this guy's running away from a campfire with a bunch of swords. Like, this is a card of like theft, right? But if we've got an ascribed meaning that we've smashed in from beforehand, it's difficult to, it's like a shift in technique. It's like you start there. And for me, the key is just to let people just park it and you can come back to it later. But for me, that's the technique that makes it look like ornithomancy, makes it look like more antique, more atavistic forms of fortune telling, is make sure you go to the oracle with an actual question so that the cosmos can respond, and then make sure that you understand, or make sure that you have a framework to interpret the logic, the omen logic of its response, and staying with what's like gestalt and then the pictures on the cards as giving you, let's say, 70% of the meaning in almost every case. Sometimes it's not. Sometimes, because it's a curious trickster style system, sometimes it will wink at you and give you like a saucy version of a classic Golden Dawn meaning, almost like as a joke, like, haha, you know how you rag on all these traditional, like, well, not even traditional, these ascribed meanings? Well, this time I'm going to deliver it to you, and I'm going to do it as a joke just to dunk on you. So when I say 70% of the meaning comes from gestalt, looking at what's on the cards and what the cards are doing to each other, that's, let's say, 70% of the time. Sometimes, because you are dealing with omen logic, you have to understand that there are, you have to understand spirit humor, I suppose, and that real Papagede, almost ribald, like dad jokes, but only slightly better energy to synchronicitous humor. That's the machine elf jokes. And the cards will respond with that. And so you need to be aware that the techniques that I use are the techniques that I share in this book, like literal physical techniques, work most of the time, but they're contained within an understanding that the what you were doing is mysterious and alive, and it will go to pains to remind you of that when you get too confident.
Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense. You've already kind of hinted at it. You speak a little bit about the difference between a sort of like more Anglo-American style of tarot divination reading sessions as opposed to continental style or European style. Can you go into a little bit more detail about that? Because I think that's fascinating and very important for these cards.
Yeah, they are. So the Anglo-American style is another, it was a less wordy way of saying Golden Dawn and All Who Sail In Her. And the 20th century tarot moment, which is 100 years, is basically all Golden Dawn, right? So anything that's into this knowledge, when I say late, like mid-magical career, but when I was getting my first decks as a kid, I never resonated with the Smith-Waite deck. And I really like Pamela Coleman Smith as an artist and as a person, historically speaking. So, but I just didn't, it wasn't there for me. And this deck, this hastily assembled and as a result, like curiously genius bit of work, most of the cards that we use are downstream from that. So simply when we talk about tarot, and this is only mostly true, a more continental approach is informed more by the Marseille, which I'd always resonated with more anyway than the Smith-Waite. And the more Anglo-American approach is downstream from the imagery of the Smith-Waite, which is downstream from that assembly of astrological and esoteric meanings. Now, the European approach looks more at the, and it's funny, like the best and craziest fortune telling I ever had in the European approach was actually in New Orleans. So in an Anglo-American context, and the woman was trying to pickpocket me at the same time, but she was reading like Trump, Marseille only Trumps. And it was my mother and I, and she was just describing literally the pictures that are on the cards and trying to pickpocket me at the same time. And so my best example of that is there, right? Which is the European approach is smaller cards, faster responses. So typically you don't have the 1 hour astrological spread sessions where we move slowly and like getting your hair cut. And there's a case for it, right? Like in a Western context, if you get a 1 hour reading with someone, you come out of it hopefully having your questions answered, but also like you've had your hair cut. Like, I feel kind of good because I've just spent an hour talking about me. And there's medicine in that. There's no doubt, right? The European approach is more shorter cards, like three cards, five cards, answer the question, onto the next one, and much more conversational. So you're more likely to have clarifying cards thrown out around it based on individual questions. And it's the images that are on them are more important than the traditionally associated meanings that might be in a book. So that's the broad difference between the two of them is no big spreads like Celtic Cross and Up generally, and like smaller, more precise questions in sequence. So instead of like, tell me what's coming up for me over the next year, like not so much annual spreads as much more prosaic. And there's a case to be made for both of them. Again, I prefer the European, but I appreciate especially in good hands, the more Anglo-American approach, where I can talk about myself and it becomes half therapy. You just feel really good at the end of it. And hopefully you've got some of your questions answered as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Again, context is everything, and also properly applied.
Exactly.
Inside that context as well.
You can get a bad reading in either the continental or Anglo-American approach.
Yes, neither is a guarantee. But that goes into kind of a little bit of the technique, the power of the imagery and the way that the cards speak through that continental style. You speak about the flow and how within this style of reading, it is very important to, well, I mean, Camellia, like, just read what's on the cards. Obviously, we can talk about that. But essentially that you are seeing how the cards flow as a whole within what is laid out and seeing how they interact and then making a story that is showing that. It is less about the spread. I appreciated your distinction about, because I personally have never really read in spreads. It even when I was a kid, it never made. I tried Celtic Cross, man, did I try for years. It never really worked for me. I know it works for many people, but that idea of finding the flow.
Read possibly this year, yesterday, just because we have a mutual love of Team Matthews, and it was a Matthews deck, and I'm like, you know what, I'm just going to go with, and I even looked at the front to see, like, how have you described Celtic Crossbred, and I did it, and it was, I mean, I got my answer, but it's not for me. Anyway,
I've gotten readings from other people that have read from me using Celtic Cross, super successful, really spot on, but there is that idea of reading in a flow, which we can talk about imagery and the realness of the imagery is possibly with that, but it is another form of kind of trying to help people understand. If you are attempting to read for yourself or someone else, and someone says to just read what is on the card, and you get fish, mice, crossroads, and you don't have a background in that, that does kind of seem like a confusing direction. Could you maybe kind of help talk through what you mean by that and how you would come to a story?
Sure. So again, if we had a question to go with it and then pulled some out, it would work better, but we'll do just a little bit of technique first. So what's on the cards is visual initially, the first 50% of it. And then the second 50% of it, this is a Camelliaism, right, is function. So we look and go, if fish, what was it? Fish, mice, crossroads.
I'm trying to remember what I came up. Fish, mice, crossroads.
Yeah. So function then becomes wealth in the sense of fish market, little loss, decisions. Because a crossroads function is to open up different paths for you. Mice in this very ratatouille context we have in the cards is like having things eaten. And fish, I deliberately wanted to make, because fish is a weird one for wealth. And I deliberately wanted to play with that, because it's plainly a Piscean thing, right? Like, so people would know if a fish showed up. The images that are used in Lenormand are broadly from coffee ground reading, which are broadly from tea leaf reading. So it's like, if you got a fish shape in your tea leaves or coffee grounds, you would say that's lucky, that's wealth, that's, you know, and that comes from Pisces, it comes from Jupiter. So I wanted, but we don't have that. I mean, we do, but generally speaking, culture doesn't have that immediate association between fish, Pisces, Jupiter, wealth. They think fish, right? And so I made sure that the card is Venetian, so it's got that wealth, joy, prospect to it. So you look at it and go, okay, so that's like money and happiness and whatever, and then you've got a little bit of loss, and then you've got making a decision. So making the decision will incur a small loss. So this decision-making process is going to cost you some money. If you were looking to decide between three or four destinations to travel, it's like, well, you will probably end up losing a deposit somewhere in the course of this decision-making process. So it won't be a whole bunch of money, but that's how you do it. You look and go, well, does fish, mice, crossroads, do I tell some sort of golden book Milo and Otis story of like a friendly fish and a mouse going on a journey together? Maybe. I'm not quite sure what your question would be in that context, but when we say what's on the cards, the bit interestingly enough, it works better for Marseille, right? Because there are more humans. There are more humans in the typically Trump's-only version, so that you can see that it's a play of humans doing things to each other more easily in most cases. With Lenormand, what's on the cards is 50% visual and then 50% function. And you do that in the terms of the same pass. So for me, it's like you look at the cards visually and go, the story isn't, the gestalt isn't in the first 1 second, which would happen if it was just as described. It's in second number three, or maybe two and a half, where you go, okay, wealth, little loss, decisions, right? And it's because of the, you drop down to function rather than meaning. And that's crucial because meaning is at tertiary level. The best card to tell the difference in is in the moon. So the traditional Lenormand meaning of the moon is reputation. And that's tertiary. That's a good example of that might be the case in some readings. But in between now and then, the moon is nighttime. The moon is reflecting. The moon is has a lot more of the dream psychological stuff that it gets from tarot. But in Lenormand specifically, it also means reputation. So it's, but we do that tertiary. So if the moon was in those cards, if it was like, let's just do moon, let's replace fish. So we'll do moon, mice, crossroads. So that would be like making the decision to go out at night will cost you some money, right? Like it's go or like maybe more than you expected. So an evening of little cost and decision making, like little expenses. That's an instance where the moon means nighttime. The moon means moon, and that's reading on the cards. That's that's what's on it, right? Now sometimes it will mean reputation, and it comes through. But that's the key difference between function and meaning. You'll know the difference, like meaning is tertiary. It's like, well, the moon doesn't mean reputation. I understand how it got to that. I understand because it's literally reflected light. It's light that beams down on people. Like it's, I understand how the logic of why it signifies reputation. Like I get the almost like animus logic of it. It's reflected light. It's someone else's reflection, right? So I understand it, but it's tertiary. And that's the key, I think, when you're looking at what's on them is it immediately obvious visually? And if not, follow it on with function. And the difference, yeah, you find meaning in a camellia sense, like a traditional ascription or association, is more artificial. It's further on. You notice it more with the pips, right? Where one of them will mean slander. And it's like, well, it doesn't mean that. That's it, like, it can carry that as a tertiary observation, or like two of swords is two swords. That's what it is to start with, and then it can be impromptu quick decision making or whatever is a tertiary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I will just point out that part of the what was missing there, which immediately was apparent, was that when I just listed off those cards without a question, there's no flow. So there is no, you had to make up a question in order to then have that flow, because the question comes first, which you make very clear within the book. And I think that that ties back into the idea of ceremony, which you talk about in the book. And there's a Robin Wall Kimmerer quote that you include about ceremony as a vehicle for belonging. I don't have the exact quote, but essentially it is that that ceremony, while it has sort of become this sort of dried husk, meaning something boring for most, you know, for most modern peoples, is not actually its correct definition. It is about coming back into relation, which ties back into you can't relate if you don't have a question. So with ceremony, first, is there anything you want to speak about with that? Because it's such a beautiful and important topic, but also, is there anything that you want to say about the act, the ceremony of beginning? Because I agree with you, the point that you make in the book, that really the ceremony opens with the moment when you decide or realize that you need to ask a question, that first beginning moment of conceptualizing, hey, I think I need to ask the cards about this. What is this exactly? That is its beginning. Is there anything else around the beginning that you want to talk about?
So Josephine McCarthy, I got this idea from her, said magical perspective. As soon as you begin to think about doing some kind of ritual or ceremony, the ceremony has in some sense begun. Like that's the beginning point for it. And I've been sitting with that and using that for 20, 25 years now, as a, well, 20 years, Magic of the North Gate, that's what that was in. That applies to fortune telling and coming to the cards with a question, because one, it's a form of magic, but two, if you, the formulation of the question is the beginning moment of that ceremony. A question that not just like, oh, will I go to IKEA? More like, actually, probably you could even, I'm just thinking now, you could do some ridiculous astrological chart casting off something, off that question. If you ended up in IKEA, you ended up in like a fight over the last draft excluder in IKEA, you could be like, where, how did this escalated quickly? Where, let me throw a chart for this. You could probably do that. That's not a useful example. It's just silly. It's when you understand the significance of the question as like the metaphysical significance of a question, you can't not take the reading of cards as some form of ceremony. Now, that does not mean you need to put on your like star and half moon pointy hat and light candles and all the rest of it. I actually find, again, the example being having myself pickpocketed, well, almost pickpocketed while my card read in the French Quarter in New Orleans. That's ceremony. Like whenever you do cards, you're in place. So card readings in a cool chaos magic sense underneath a bridge, or sitting in a beautiful 18th century parlor, like these things are all part of the ceremony of it. And one of the reasons I went to pains in the book to tell the story of the metaphysics of play and almost like the technological history of printing that has, both of these things have given us cards, is that you can just, it is ceremony when you formulate a question and you step into the understanding that what you're about to do is older than humanity and involves a technology that goes back to Egypt. And like literally it does go back to Egypt. This is one of the things they, Etea and the rest of them tracked the wrong thing, right? They actually could have tracked the technology and been correct about tarot cards coming from Egypt. So it is instantaneously ceremony to understand that a question is cosmically significant and that the act of posing it to the cards is vastly ancient. That's enough of an invocation. That's literally enough of an invocation, right? I obviously, as you do, I put a little bit more stank on it when it comes to getting ready to read some cards. But even just stepping into the, what I'm doing is big. Even if it's a little, will I go to IKEA question, but like what I'm doing is big. And one of the things that is useful, particularly once you get to the sitting down point, and I learned this from Marseille, the open reading, is whatever happens from the moment you sit down or even like turn the light on in the room you're going to be reading, whatever it happens to be, whatever happens when you actually step into the ceremonial process of reading cards, everything that happens to you is a response to your question. So if you get interrupted, if there's a fire alarm, if something gets knocked over, obviously, famously, if cards flip out of the deck, like I have a rule that if I see a card of any kind during the process, it's somehow involved, right? Because I've asked a question and I've gone to the cards. It doesn't matter if my, you know, my tiny Trump hands can't handle the cards. It's still like, it's still part of what happened, because everything is part of what happened. And that, one, is probably metaphysically true, but it comes back to what you were saying before about attending and noticing. It's if you, it, what you're priming your attentiveness and your noticing. If you step into, okay, whatever's going on from now is going to be part of it. You're actually opening up that attending capacity anyway, even if you were subsequently going to mostly direct it towards the cards.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, that's one of the limitations of relying on the meanings that have accrued from other time periods. Not that they aren't useful or potentially sometimes true, but just that if it causes you to lose sight of the other parts of the attending, the other parts of noticing, just because you're so fixated on, oh my God, I took that 6-month tarot course and I think I forgot what the Seven of Swords was. Then you may miss the thunderstorm that's happening outside.
Right. Or worst, criminal of criminals go to jail if you keep throwing cards, keep tarot cards especially, waiting for one particular one to show up because you've decided that that means he loves you.
Or but I that's want the lovers.
Basically the use case of that. Exactly. It's like just, yeah, that one. Yeah. Yes. And that, this process works because I think it says something about the universe, but it has the added benefit of moving you into a more appropriate mode for fortune telling, almost despite yourself, right? So, yeah.
So with that, I think the question then becomes, I agree with you that there has to, A, be a question, because it is that question which sort of starts everything off. Otherwise, we don't have a way to begin even talking about this. But then, is there a process that you think about for ending that? I mean, if you are reading for someone else, you know, obviously you have an hour. Okay, your hour is up. Hour is over. The reading time is done. But if it was not that clear cut, how do you think about endings and sort of like cutting that
back?
No
one's ever asked that before. And it suddenly occurred to me that that should have been in the book, because that's really good. So there isn't one distinct thing. Very often, and I learned this speaking of New Orleans from the New Orleans Voodoo Tarot, that some spreads, like, and this is, they were spreads then, like Celtic crosses and whatever, I leave to cook. So because I now have a larger space dedicated to shamanic healing and magic and cards and so on, which is up in the guest house, it's not at a kitchen table, which then needs to be cleared to prepare a meal. So some of them I will leave to cook, particularly if I'm doing like a big Lenormand layout for a larger question. So if we're doing a grand tableau, I will leave it. And it's almost like you pick at it, right? Like I can come back and look at it later. But then there are other instances where, so the John and Caitlin Matthews spread that I did yesterday, I got the answer I wanted. It was not good, but it was clear. And I'm like, oh, well, you know, I got the message is no, I don't need to, I don't need to keep looking at these for any additional meaning, right? So they get bundled up. I don't actually have a ceremonial ending for them, but very often, so when I read cards for clients, they're in the context of a client session, which has a lineage specific opening and closing on either side of it. So it's a good question. Like I don't have a definitive ending. Some of them I leave to cook depending on the question and me wanting to have a look at it. Other times they fold back up in, but yeah, I don't do, there's nothing specific, probably because very often my card readings are contained within another ceremony, but not always.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's something where I was thinking about in the context of someone asked me, when do you decide that you have enough information to decide on a meaning? And I think that's kind of part of it, where there's an element of the flow where you just know when you know, or it's so obvious. Yeah, the answer is no. I'm sorry. There's no way to reinterpret that.
The person who asked you that, hopefully it's in a cocktail party situation where you can throw a wine in their face, because what they're actually asking is, how do I contort myself into a pretzel so that I can extract the answer I want from cards that obviously haven't given it to me? When I hear a question like that, I get very camellia. I'm like, nope. They fucking told you in the first second, you just don't want to hear it. And that's that's unfortunately a skill that people have to learn, right? Yeah. Which is questions have two answers. They have yes and they have no. And they will show up approximately like flipping a coin, yes or no. And when people say to decide on a meaning, I would pull that back and say, you've asked a bullshit question. Like you've asked a question that isn't appropriate to cards and isn't, it might be five questions. It's too vague or too specific. Or you're sitting there looking at a does he still love me spread filled with swords. And the answer is obvious, but you're like, but this one could be this, or maybe he's making a snap decision to come back to me because there's the two of swords. It's like, no. Like usually I get a like delightful alarm bells when I hear people say, how long do you wait to decide on a meaning? I'm like, he's not coming back. I'll save you the time.
Yeah. No, that is very excellent. That goes to you have a short in the book, but I think very succinct little discussion of the morals of reading. And you emphasize a couple of times the importance of being honest, but not cruel. And I really like that description, because I think it's a great way of keeping that framework in mind. it's very important, as you point out, to be honest with what you are told, because otherwise the spirits, in many traditions, I completely agree, may withhold that gift. Because if it is not being honored and you're not speaking truthfully, why should they continue to allow you to be a vessel for that? There's no reason. You're not going to do it anyway. But how do you view, or what would you want to speak to for people who are saying, you know, how much morality do I put into whether I say yes or no to doing a reading for someone, or whether I should just say, no, I don't read on that?
Interesting question. So if I turn it into follow-up questions that we can read on, because if people are asking you to read on something that violates a boundary for you, I don't have this exact boundary where some people won't read for people who aren't in the room. Like, so an ex-wife reading for an ex-husband, they won't do that. I'll do that. That's not where my boundaries are. I understand if people have them there. If the question then becomes, what are the best ways to sabotage my ex-husband's car and house so that he has a near fatal accident? That hits some lines for me, right? But what we hear there is a wounding. What we hear there is a woman who is not over that. So you, or man, but like, so that you go, okay, let's dig deeper into where that impulse is coming from. And it's like, I am still carrying a lot of hurt from a betrayal that happened 2 years ago. And I just can't think without it. I'm like, well, now we're getting into question territory. Now we're getting into somewhere where the cards can help us with, tell me that, like, this would be like, tell me the story of the persistence of this hurt. So usually when someone gets near a moral boundary, their real question, because generally speaking, the real question is the second question anyway. People will ask the first one and you don't say, that's a bullshit question. What you really mean is this, but you do tease out of them. Okay, so you're asking is the guy at work the person I'm going to marry? It's like, so you're asking when is my next long-term entanglement that leads to marriage and what can I do to get there, right? So part of the fortune teller's job, because we are the keepers of the questions, like if we go back to this oracular understanding, is to help people ask the question that you know the cards are going to facilitate the delivery of the most medicine with. So that's what I do when I hit a boundary. Like, I'm not going to read like crazy stalker behavior, but let's talk about where that capacity or that, why you're still carrying that energy and what you need to share and what you need to explore to complete that healing process.
Mm-hmm. Which also then allows it to be the way that I also think about that, except for things like that. If they're talking about dangerous behavior or something like that, then I'm going to probably push it. But it's also, you know, sometimes someone may need to know the answer to something that maybe you personally don't think they do, but it's part of their journey. Yeah. That's the question they need to ask. So, okay, I'm not here to judge.
What more commonly happens for me is when people ask, should I take this job or should I do whatever? And I get cards that are not good, like, and how I say it is, based on these cards, I would not take the job. So when it comes to delivering around giving people honest but not cruel advice, you don't say, no, you don't get this job. You continue to slave away in that cubicle with the boss who hates you. It's more because I appreciate why someone would want to take any job if they're in a terrible situation or whatever. So when I get to those readings where I can tell they want the answer to be yes, or they want it to be better than it is, I say, based on these cards, exactly those words, if it were me, I would not take the job. But of course, live your life. Of course, go and do your things. So that's how I bring the frames in. I either surface the question that that is underneath the wound, or I make it about, which would be true, like based on these cards, I would not take the job. So that's that honesty rather than cruelty. And that's really all they can expect. I mean, it's all I expect from getting a reading is someone going like, I am doing my best to tell you the card's story in response to your question. And together we are arriving at a next step.
There's so I do oracular work, and my best friend, who's also co-high priestess with me, also does oracular work, but more in a Norse context. And she always tells the story of how at one point she in sight just kept seeing chicken feet. And she was trying to come up with other ways to say it, but eventually the spirits were just like, "You're going to say chicken feet." So she just had to blurt out chicken feet, chicken feet, chicken feet, chicken feet over and over again. And this is exactly what the person needed to hear and was the perfect answer to them. But that was not about guiding the question or about guiding the answer, but simply accepting what was coming through. And there's no need sometimes to be too much of a filter for that, which is really beautiful. We have not spoken about, well, we have, but directly spoken about magical uses with the cards. So we've spoken about how kind of like when we approach asking a question, we are already doing something that has danger and power and possibility within it, which is why it's so important for, you know, that first act. However, past that, is there anything that you would want to talk about for people who are going to be experimenting with this deck about how you see the possibility of doing mediation or magical work with the cards?
I'd probably just broaden it out to cards in general and say it can absolutely sure. apply with these ones as well. So the Fortune's Fool's deck has a specific magical goal, which it's achieved most of. But one of them is a recentering of Madame Lenormand herself in where I believe she belongs in the Pantheon. I think she should be more famous than Atea, to be honest. Anyway, if people don't know, the official story is Marianne Adelaide Lenormand had nothing to do with the Lenormand deck that was made in her name. But she was like the Mystic Meg of the 19th century. Like, she's famous. It's like naming something after it. So that's a bit unfair, right? Because she did have this whole fucking career. And because of that, this is what the cards are named of. She had nothing to do with it. Well, no, she wasn't sitting there with a quill or like a drawing pencil, like going, oh, and the fish should look like this. It's not like that. And I was in the jungle last year on Dieta in the Amazon, explaining this deck to the woman who convenes our Dietas. She's this incredible, like, raw vegan girl boss in Florida. And I was explaining this whole story and how, like, part of what Colin and I wanted to do is bring, like, Lenormand back. And I was explaining this exact bit. And she said, she sounds exactly like the kind of woman who could arrange a deck to be made in her name after her death. And I'm like, that's exactly it, right? So part of the spell is to bring back, is to send to her. Now, so this deck has some very specific things that it will unpack from a magical perspective. From the consecration that is involved in there coming from Spanish witch trials and so on. I've built it so that it will pull you into or invite you to step into a European cunning tradition current. So that's there. But more generally speaking, using cards in magic, and this is funny, like, am I self-justifying my overspending on cards by saying this or not? But I very often have different decks to communicate with different spirits or classes of spirits. So that one of the things you can do with, and it's arguably better with 36 cards rather than a full tarot, but you can, of course, go Trump only, is you can call in spirits and with a deck that is theirs to speak to you through. And you can kind of do like a beginning and end discussion, right? So you can call them in and get, like, if you have something that you want them to do, opening question, do the magic, make the offerings, whatever it happens to be, more cards again to see how that landed, right? That is a very classic and ancient approach to storytelling, or to sorcery, to use a opening and closing oracle to understand whether the spirits are either pleased with your offering or prepared to do something. That for me is the best, like, sorcerous use case for cards, is to have them as a telephone for communication with spirits that either you don't have other capacities to, like, you're not as good at channeling or what have you, or they're just spirits that you don't wish to channel. So there are ones that, like, don't like to talk that way. There are ones that you probably shouldn't be inviting in, and so on. So that's the best use case for them, for me, is in those contexts, communication with spirits. I know that there are other opportunities to, like, and this is, I learned this from the New Orleans voodoo tarot, that you can lay out a so-called beneficial reading and activate that. I've had mixed experience with that over the decades, right? Like I used to do that and it would sort of work, but sort of not. And then I started this, like incorporating sigils into it and arranging it so that I would have nice cards and sigils together. And that worked better. But then it's like, well, isn't it just the sigils that's doing it at that point? So I know that's a common, if that works for people, go for it. But for me, the best use of cards in a magical context is spirit communication.
And information in that sense. I agree. I think that it goes back to something else that you touch on, which you've said many times, but the idea of reading yourself to filth, which I think I really should not neglect that as a thing we talk about before this interview ends, because I think it's really important. So if you're, because it does tie into that. I agree. I think there's a case and a time for using, like laying out a great spread and using it in magic because you want to bring that about, like sigils and any other type of magic. But its great strength is in finding, you know, find the traps. So, you know, you want to actually use it for the thing that it's best at, as opposed to putting it in a context that you can also, there's plenty of other magic you can do with that.
That's a good way of saying it, right? Like for me, from an optimization perspective, the cards don't belong at like the front end of practical enchantment. They belong like at the at a communication level. So, and I know people love cards. I mean, I love cards, but I know people love cards and want it to be like, how do I do magic with these? And it's an optimization of ceremony or enchantment perspective where you can, like, I'm more interested in getting the results that I want rather than using cards in a way that feels good to me, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah.
I like, I'm just coming back to the read yourself to filth. It's so important because we have a natural tendency approaching the cards to look for the positive rather than negative reading. There's something randomly that Jordan Peterson said about the poor in spirit, as in blessed are the poor in spirit, which is, I mean, he got it. It's a Jungian phrase or interpretation, but the poor in spirit are blessed because they are, to be poor in spirit is not like how I was taught it in school anyway, is to be forever grateful. Even though if you have abundance, to be poor in spirit is to be grateful for that that one piece of fruit or that small amount of beans or lentils that you had. Like it's a gratitude play, which never occurred to me. So it's like the meek inheriting the earth and blessed are the poor in spirit. The poor in spirit are poor in spirit because they are always grateful for whatever it is they receive. And there's an element of reading yourself to filth that maps to that somewhat, where if you are not so much expecting the worst, but you are grateful for when even the small things arrive, that you're actually individuating quite well. You're actually like moving on a direction of being like, oh, well, I didn't get a Lamborghini, but I nevertheless did get my aunt's car, who is no longer using it. And so now I have a car to get to work that I otherwise couldn't have afforded. And there's a poor in spirit, read yourself to filth overlap there that I haven't fully thought out, but I've been sitting with. To read oneself to filth is useful in a long-term individuation play because you are hopefully not building out monstrous egoic projections, but you also might be moving more in the direction of humility and gratitude.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Which I think is also part of the whole, you know, if you see everything as an omen, you touch on that, which I've had other people kind of bring up to me when I've said, well, yeah, no, of course, I mean, omens are all around us. And they say, well, how do you not just turn into a megalomaniac who thinks every time a tree leaf falls, it's, you know, the tree talking to you, which maybe you're not that important. Yeah. But it's the same thing where when you have that kind of like core in spirit, it's a gratitude, which also keeps humility, which then I think can help deflate some of the potential dangers of the overstrong ego, which might then lead us to see things that are not about us. Because we just have gratitude and humility in the face of all of it. Tricky though.
I'd say that's built in if you're a bit concerned about that, which most people who have that problem aren't that concerned about it. But the smaller symbol set in Lenormand Like you're not, you don't get like God destroying your house personally, and you don't get the devil, and you don't get all of this stuff. You get like mice and birds, yeah, and a lily, yeah.
Yeah, it's absolutely beautiful. We have been talking for a while, and we could continue to talk for quite a while longer, I'm sure, about this stuff. But I wanted to ask if so many things. What if you could give advice to someone who is relatively new to fortune telling, and you wanted to give them some good advice for starting out, what would be something you want to leave with people?
It's really exciting because I think about this, if people could find fortunes, fools, or a no, because that's too expensive. Take the tarot course. Because that will save you money in the long run, to be a $12 a month member. What you want to do if you're starting out is find the joy and be, I guess, not so much suspicious of the rules, but find the joy and be aware that this is a field that contains mostly nonsense for denatured reasons. There are like profound life-changing transformational gems in there, and the process of fortune telling is a process of returning to relation with the living cosmos. But in those first little bits, it's like find the joy. Don't let anyone like tell you like if you want to read, I've got them in front of me. If you want to read the Golden Girls Tarot, go for it. Yeah, find the joy and be, how to say this right. Find the joy and then find what universe you are reading cards in. Is it a living cosmos or is it not? And that's going to point you in the direction of how you develop out your skill set with like fortunes, fools, or more in a Camellia Elias direction, which would be my preference. Like I said, I've seen people run the 20th century pop psychology, Golden Dawn method, and get good answers. But I think, especially if you're beginning, joy and play and decide what universe you're reading cards in, because that's gonna set the trajectory of your ship card.
That is really beautiful. Thank you. I think that's excellent advice. What would you like to share with us about what you are doing now? Obviously, there's the membership, which is fantastic, and I recommend to everyone. Is there anything else you want to let people know about, or what you want to tell people about your
The members
project?
of we're doing. What are we doing? We're doing prayer as the next course. I'm beginning in a month and a half. Yeah, that's it. Runesoup.com for all of that. I'm working on the final book in the Dot Trilogy, but that's a little bit delayed, sadly, but it's fine. That's what I'm doing with this summer. I'm writing my book. There are still some fortunes fools available, but that's it. If anyone's interested, it's all there at runesoup.com.
That's very cool. Thank you so much, Gordon. I really appreciate it. And until
You're
next time,
very
I always
welcome.
love talking to you, so.
Yes, always a pleasure. Always a pleasure.
Black moon above, stars overhead, don't you dare guide me back to my bed. The river is frozen. Thorns in